Good morning. Nice to see friends here. Friends I've known for a long time. Friends I may not have met. Nice to see you all. I think I'm just going to dive in. Are you ready to dive in? Sometimes there's standing in the shallows and then walking out. Sometimes there's diving in. So this talk is called Mind Only is Total Engagement. Mind Only being sort of a principle of Buddhist thought, also sometimes thought of as a school of Buddhist thought, mind only being about taking care of mind. Or maybe that we don't know anything outside of mind, which could be kind of a puzzling assertion. But if I just call your attention to the quote on the bulletin today, which says, everything conceived as self or other occurs in the transformation of consciousness. That is to say, when we talk about mind only, we talk about everything that you experience. So if you experience it, you or something else, we're calling that mind only, which might seem like a strange way to talk about things, but maybe I'll make some sense of it as we go. This is definitely not a talk about just thinking about stuff a whole lot. Not that kind of mind only. So, and this idea of mind only suggests that we focus on a couple of things. Focus on producing mind states that are pleasant and helpful, not producing mind states that are painful and harmful, and producing mind states that see the connection between what we think ourself and other, rather than alienation and separation. So this mind-only idea, like I say, it becomes this school of thought in the middle of the first century in India, and there's all these elaborate crazy texts. I'm toting one with me today that deal with mind-only. In a way, you could say it all comes out of the emphasis in Buddhist thought on taking care of what you choose to do and what your mind is doing. So if you look at the Eightfold Path, there's nothing in it, and nothing in almost any Buddhist teaching, about trying to control other people or other things. There's a lot of teachings about how to choose to do the thing that will be most helpful, offering your effort and letting go. So, and there's a big emphasis, as you probably know, I think we're called the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, on meditation, because meditation practice is a way for us to transform the way the mind works. And, you know, if we look at the basic, I think of the Eightfold Path as the most basic teaching of Buddhism. It really says, make a commitment to alleviating suffering through compassionate action and meditation. So we put a lot of emphasis on meditation practice here at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center because all people receive some degree of training in compassionate action. You go to elementary school and you learn how to share, hopefully. We don't do a very good job of sharing, really. If you go around the world and you look at how well things are shared, and you look at what we have here in the United States, and you look at what people have in Central Africa, you will realize, wow, we're not really doing the sharing. But we have some training. We have some training, and we do somewhat well. But most people are not raised with any training in meditation. And training the mind is really de-emphasized, because what we're trained to do is distinguish and objectify objects and try and control them. And Buddhism really suggests that that is not a way that is really going to be the most effective way to promote well-being for everyone, including yourself and everyone you don't know. Everyone out there, all the little ants and the fishes who are going, no, I don't really want more crazy chemicals in this ocean. Through meditation, we might be able to find a way to train the mind to do something more helpful. So this idea of mind only, I'm just going to throw out numerous quotes that give the flavor of it from, ooh, that's my mind making that sound. The flavor of this. So the Dhammapada is a really, it's one of the earlier texts of Buddhist thought. And the first, it's a big long thing. And the first couple of lines are, our life is shaped by our mind. We become what we think. Suffering follows a harmful thought like the wheels of a cart follow the oxen that draws it. Our life is shaped by our mind. We become what we think. Joy follows a beneficial thought like a shadow that never leaves. So we start here with the mind. Then, let's see. We get Bodhidharma, who's the near mythical founder of Zen, and we have very few teachings that come down to us from Bodhidharma, but direct pointing to the mind. He says what Zen is direct pointing to the mind, and what Zen is a mind-to-mind transmission. Sounds like mind is interesting to the guy. We go to the third ancestor, Sengsan, who wrote one of the most seminal texts of Buddhism. It's called Trust in Mind. You go to sixth ancestor, Huineng, who one day, he was at the monastery, and a couple monks were debating, and one says, the wind moves. The other says, the flag moves. And Huineng says, not the wind, not the flag, mind is moving. And then we get to the eighth generation, where Shito founds what will become Soto Zen, and Matsu founds what will become Linji. Shito likes to talk to people about how things are. Matsu likes to shout and startle people into enlightenment. Different approaches. Are you waiting for me to shout? I'm not in Matsu's lineage. I don't know how. So, Shito opens his most famous text, The Harmony of Difference and Sameness, by saying the mind of the great sage of India is intimately transmitted. And Matsu, when asked what is Buddha, said, this very mind is Buddha. So I guess these guys think it's important. I should confess that I think later on someone asked Matsu, what is Buddha? And he said, not mind. So that's the problem with Zen. We do tend to flip it back on its head. But this emphasis on mind is big. I should just briefly say that this is not a mind that is separate from anything. So if we stick, I talk about mind, and we're used to the word mind in this way, but maybe a better word would be awareness or experience. Consciousness, in when you're, I use mind only in this talk because it's the normal translation that's used in the Zen context. In Indian, they usually say consciousness only, but in terms of describing what we're talking about, experience only or awareness only would be more accurate, which is to say we know the one thing we can probably agree on right now is that we're having an experience. If we're not having an experience, I can't talk to you and you can't hear me. So, right? So, but what this really says is beyond that, we really don't know diddly. We have all these ideas that are this idea that there's a self here perceiving things and that you're out there and I'm over here and you probably think this way and you're thinking too intellectual and you're thinking, wow, this is trippy. You know, we have a lot of ideas about this, but they're all just ideas. None of them are ultimately real. What we know is we're having an experience right now, mind only. What are we going to do with this? So this relates really closely to all the Zen teachings that say, just this. Just this. We start to get really wound up, and the teacher says, just what's here? Mind only is what's here. An experience. We don't really know. This is intended to dissolve the sense that we're a self separate from other objects. And so the word mind is a little bit problematic for that reason. Definitely not about some kind of like, we're going to be super minds and leave our bodies behind. Absolutely not. In fact, the basic practice of Soto Zen and all Buddhism is to be deeply, deeply aware and connected to the body. When I do Zazen, what I'm doing is I'm just being this breath. And really the idea is, normally my little mind thinks, oh, I'm up here controlling things. I have a body that I will carry around to achieve my ends, my magical ends of getting to work. And this separation between the mind and the body is illusory. And our practice enables us to see that it's just awareness. It's just awareness only, mind only. Likewise, the same can happen with the people that you hate, the people that you love. You can realize that you're not even connected to them, because you don't have to be connected, because there's no separation within which a connection has to occur. So this kind of ties back somehow to this. If any of you guys were at Martin's Dharma Talk a couple of years ago on the seminal Mahayana text, Row, Row, Row Your Boat. So at the end of that amazing gatha, there is the line, life is but a dream. Life is but a dream. Now, life is but a dream is a really common teaching, particularly in Mahayana Buddhism, but you see it in the earliest Buddhist texts as well. And the basic way it's thought of and interpreted is it points out that we tend to get really, really stuck on stuff and think we have everything figured out, and it causes us to suffer a lot. And I don't know about you guys, but the more I'm like, I've got this figured out, I've got the plan, the other people have the wrong plan, I'm going to show up and I'm going to explain the plan, once they're convinced, everything will be cool. This is something that happens in this mind. This life is but a dream teaching can soften that. I go, oh, I don't really know. I don't really know. Am I sure? So these kind of teachings can soften that. But mind only, the mind only school really emphasizes another side of the teaching that life is but a dream. And that is the side that this experience right now is conditioned by infinite things. So it's already totally engaged in everything in the universe. We have this moment right now. We don't really know what it is. Our mind, our little mind, tends to think, oh, I know exactly what's going on. But really, we don't. But it's totally just dependent on an infinite, inconceivable array of things. And it is part of the creation of the entire infinite, unknowable dependencies of everyone else's awareness that will ever exist. So it's conditioned, which is kind of like a dream. Does anyone here have recurring dreams? How many people have recurring dreams that are in this room? Wow. Not that I have a lot. Wow. I have a lot of recurring dreams. I am often just trying to achieve a task that is unending. Oh, maybe that's being a bodhisattva. But, you know, like, I keep trying to do the thing and it keeps slipping away. I used to have those ones when I was a child where I'd try and run and my body would not move. So, you know, some people have recurring dreams, some don't. But, you know, most psychologists would agree that the contents of our dreams have to do with our conditioning. The degree to which that can be interpreted really finely is in question now, I think. But yeah, our conditioning produces this dream. And this is why mind-only teachings are most helpful. Because not only they give us the thing that we don't know what's happening here, really. Let's soften our belief that we've got it all figured out. But they point out that what we experience in this moment and what we put in to what will be all further experience creates that experience. We co-create a dream. This means that your effort is really important. It's really important. That co-created dream is always connected to everyone. So this life is but a dream teaching, you know, the dangerous side is we go, ah, shoot, well, life is but a dream. Let's see what happens. I don't care. I'm just going to ride along in my boat. Whereas this mind-only teaching says, this dream, when they're suffering in this dream, it's because of conditioning. And if there is more suffering, it will be because of conditioning. If there is peace, if there is kindness, if there is beneficial action in this dream, it's because of conditioning. And if those things exist in the future, it will be because of conditioning. And what Buddhism is will not deny is that you actually have a choice in this moment. You have a moment of input into the system. The system is infinitely vast. It's daunting. I won't deny that. But you always have an opportunity. This is the most basic and central teaching of Buddhism. You always have an opportunity to contribute to how this dream unfolds. Now you might think, well, really? How much of a dream is it? Well, let's just begin to take some examples. So let's say you ever know different people in your life and they come to visit you on a plane. Are there not people who, when you say, how was it? You're pretty sure they're going to say, oh, it's pretty good. It was nice. And there's going to be someone who will let out a litany of complaints. That's been my experience. I mean, there are some degree to which, you know, conditions change and people have some more complaints in certain circumstances. But there are people who every time I meet them after they get off a plane, they complain at length. I don't know, maybe they just always have the really bad rides. So that's just one example. But someone raises up the Confederate flag. Do people have the same reaction to that experience? I don't think so. One of my students, who's science-y, actually he's a scientist. Wow, that's cool. We were talking, he said, yeah, well, you know, color isn't real. Color is not real. It looks pretty real. We all agree on it. Well, most people agree on it. Some people are colorblind. They're like, nope, I don't know. But we have, you know, it seems pretty darn real. And we have all this language and culture to say, yep, it's real. But it's a product of the way the apparatus of our consciousness and our organs function. And you can say, well, yeah, sure, buddy, but it's, you know, it's waveforms. That's still just a description. Whatever those waveforms are, or are they photons? How many descriptions do you want? Those things are not ultimately real. There are things that we agree on that are useful, but if we begin to soften the tendency to just harden around what we know, oh, I just know this is real, something can open up in us, some possibility for connection, some possibility for being able to get close to what's here. You know, you look at addicts, people, and having been one, I've been in recovery for a really long time, you know, the things that I did were crazy. Anyone would be like, why on earth would you do that? And yet, it seemed obvious to me. What else would you do? Or, if we look at perception, seems to be a pretty well-established fact that in the United States, most people associate danger and bad things with people who have dark-colored skin. And there are lots of psychological tests that demonstrate this. I, as a person who have been really interested in and done a marginal but some amount of work for promoting racial justice in this country since I was a little kid, if I take a test that shows whether I have racial bias that thinks that, like, associates negative stuff with black people, the answer is yes. What can I do? Keep working. Keep working. I could be like, oh, wow. I don't have to be ashamed of it. I can just say, wow, I'm part of a really big system that causes a lot of suffering. I'm willing to do something about it. I'm willing to just kind of notice what my emotional reactions are like when I encounter people of different races. Well, this noticing the emotional reaction is something I'll come back to. It's one of the basic practices that this mind-only teaching suggests. Likewise, here's an interesting one I just saw. They took police officers, and they wanted to test their fast reactions. So they flashed photographs at them. The photographs had four variables. The people in the photographs were either white or black, And the people in the photographs were either holding a playing card or a firearm. And then they flashed these things and they had to identify what they were holding in their hand. And they had to do it fast. And really consistently and to a really strong degree, they tended to be more likely to misjudge a person who's holding a firearm who had a playing card in their hand if they were black. Which is, to me, like, it's like, duh. I don't know. It's just the way I was raised. Was like, of course, this is the way it is. But, you know, I guess a lot of people think it isn't true or something. But there seems to be mountains of science. And what's interesting about this is we think, well, this kind of conditioning, it just conditions how we feel. They saw a gun. People see things that are not there. Due to bias. And I'm just picking one example. I mean, I guess the question of racial bias is kind of something where we've got a little bit of energy in our culture, so maybe we're going to do something about it, which is pretty cool. But because my opinion about that is, like, it's not like it hasn't been happening, you know? So anyway, you know, people are starting to go, oh, wow, this is, you know, you can just scientifically demonstrate this. So we all have this, but my point is, I'm just picking or talking about this one little issue, but this is going on all the time. Almost everyone in the world thinks that they're like, oh, I want to get that thing. But there's tons of science showing that getting things doesn't actually promote people's happiness. So why are they doing it? Why are they doing it? No one really knows. Just a big dream. A big dream that if we have a big gross domestic product, it's going to be cool. What is that? Who even cares? Why do I care how many more billions of dollars rich people have to increase our gross domestic product? I don't know. And yet I look at it and I go, oh, GDP is up. Things are good. What the hell? It's crazy. It's a dream. It's a dream. We don't have to make the same dream. We have a choice. I call this mind only is total engagement because, one, it's already total engagement. The universe is doing this moment of experience we're having. It's doing it. Wow. It's engaged, and it will continue. That conditioning will keep going. So it's already total engagement. But probably more importantly, my point is this emphasis on working with the mind that we have in Buddhism is about total engagement. And when we practice meditation, it is not separate. It's not separate. And when we get up and do something else, it's not separate either. So, working with the mind and beginning to, one, have states of mind that are see the connection, the totality of our engagement, and that feel beneficial, kind, generous emotions, as opposed to, you know, constricted, selfish, angry emotions that are feel alienated, can really free things up. And so in the mind-only school of Buddhism, we talk about two barriers, the barrier of afflictive emotion and the barrier of delusion. So afflictive emotion is these emotions that cause us to feel suffering and cause harm. And the barrier of delusion is believing in separateness, basically. I'm just going to read some. Sometimes it's good to just read some really trippy Mahayana literature. So I'm going to hit you. This is from the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is right at the pinnacle of. You just read it and your mind goes, duh. So I'm just going to read a little bit. So if it doesn't make a lot of sense, that's fine. Just let it wash over you. So this pilgrim Sudana is going around meeting all these teachers. And he meets this teacher. The teacher, I'm just going to jump in the middle of his teaching. He says, knowing that Buddhas are like a dream, knowing my own mind is dreamlike thought. Knowing that Buddhas are like a reflection, knowing my own mind is like a vessel of clear water. Knowing that Buddhas are like a magically produced forms, knowing my mind is like magic. Knowing the nature of voices of the Buddhas is the reverberation of the sound of echoes in the mountains. Knowing my own mind is like an echo. I realize, I am mindful, that all enlightenment principles of bodhisattvas are based on one's own mind. That all the purification of Buddha lands, all enlightenment practices, all development and guidance of sentient beings, all undertakings of the vows of enlightening beings, all attainment to the ocean of omniscience, roaming in the inconceivable liberation of enlightened beings, attainment of the enlightenment of Buddhas, spiritual communion with the cosmos, and the knowledge of subtle communion with all ages are all based on one's own mind. This being said, I think that one's own mind should be supported by roots of goodness, moistened by the clouds of teaching, purified by principles that should be focused on, made firm by vigorous action, made calm by forbearance, guided by following knowledge, clarified by wisdom. So he makes this big statement that, like, wow, it's all mind. And he says, since it's all mind, what I should do is I should practice. I should put my effort into taking care of this mind, to this transformation. My responsibility. There's one other little bit I thought was pretty groovy in here. This is short. He meets another teacher. Each one of these teachers says, they say, I have attained this superpower, basically. This guy says, I have attained good works produced from the treasury of mind. To those who need food, I give food. To those who need drink, I give drink. To those who need clothing, I give clothing. To those who need flowers, I give flowers. To those who want garlands, I give garlands. To those who need chairs, I give chairs. To those who need beds, I give beds. To those who need means of transportation, I give means of transportation. To those who need medicine, I give medicine. And so on, whatever the needs, I provide them. From the treasury of mind. Because you can give stuff to people, but you got to be generous first. So, and we don't even know the limits and the capacities of our generosity. I don't think there is a limit. I certainly haven't found it, because I see where I run up against my own all the time. If we think about, you go, well, I don't know, is this really practical? This is some crazy stuff. But let's just go, okay, mind only is teaching us to be really deeply attuned to our emotional states, because that allows them to transform and become more beneficial. So be really mindful and intimate with our emotional states, and to practice meditation and teachings that make us feel connected to people. By the way, these are two central ways that Zazen functions. That's just like your weekly pitch for Zazen. So if this is the case, what would it look like if the way you experienced the world was one in which there was much less painful states of emotion that caused you to do things that were harmful, and much more states that were pleasant and caused you to do things that were beneficial, and were based all on the totality of your sense of connection to everyone? What would that be like? I mean, it's already there a little bit, right? But why not more of that? Would we be able to keep engaging in the kind of practices that let someone else eat all the suffering of our consumption? Oh, it'll be fine. Those people in Asia don't need that much money, I'm sure. They just want to get paid a pittance so I can have my cheap phone. It's cool. We could actually, you know, begin to be like, oh yeah, I would like that to be a little bit more equal. That can happen in our heart. It doesn't have to happen to, like, oh, I'm a bad person for buying a cheap phone. No, we can just begin to realize, oh, my natural inclination is to act out of the sense of connection, out of giving, out of harmony. I'm really getting trouble here because I'm talking about consumption as a bad thing in the United States is like going to a Catholic church and saying God kills babies, but I'm not going to give up. I'm not. And I do this. I do this actively. I'm thinking of a good example. I had like some kind of thing, a work thing, where it's like a group of people and we're trying to get something done. And I had a very, I knew the way that would work well. And I also knew that other people knew a way that would not. And I was like, you know, I'm sitting around for a couple days going, okay, how am I going to construct my argument? And the, you know, how am I going to use the power of my rhetoric to get done what has to be done here? I could do this. I'm good at communicating. All right. And I'm just churning away in my mind. And, you know, I kept going, this is probably ding. You know, I have a little old Zen alarm bell. Ding, ding, ding. But, you know, the power of mind is so vast. The power of conditioning is so vast. Wow. I go, oh, ding, back on the track. Back on that same cognitive track. Wow. Emotional energy just driving it. Oh, I got to get it right. These people are not going to defeat me. So, you know, I kept trying to come back to my praxis. How do I feel about this? Where's my connection to people? I had some degrees of success, but I just remember pulling up to the meeting in my car. I drive a car, and I thought, you know, this, what really matters to me? My training came up. So am I, this is not about controlling other people. What am I going to get up in front of people every week and talk about not trying to control other people and then run in and do it? I don't want to do that. I have a choice. What am I going to put into this today? What am I putting into this dream? I thought, I'm going to try and connect. I'm going to try and connect with people. I'm going to be honest about how I feel about this. I'm going to be honest about what I think should be done. And I'm going to do my best to listen. And I'm going to do my best to let go of the results. And I have no idea. It was a while ago. I have no idea what happened. What I remember is that I did my practice. What I remember is that I did my practice. So we talk a lot here at MZMC about doing meditation practice, about taking care of the mind, because Buddhism says that if we don't do that, people are just going to keep operating out of this conditioned dream. And no matter how much we're trying, all these people think they're doing the best thing. You know, there are people out there killing people that think this is the best thing I could be doing. It's going to help everybody. We have an opportunity to say we want to change that from the bottom. I can't change anyone else. I can change this heart. I can put what I can into this. And it can be daunting to look at all the suffering in the world. So if it's overwhelming, we just have to back off and take care of ourselves. But if we can get close to it and really offer ourselves, we can do something really wonderful. And so I want to end by hearing about this wonderfulness, because I think, you know, I get up here and I give this talk, and, you know, I managed to use some fancy words, so it sounds like I'm doing something, you know, that you didn't know about beforehand or something, but really what I'm talking about here is what people here are already doing. What people here are already doing. And so I want to hear about that. So I'm going to try this way. So I'm going to request that everyone maybe assume a meditative posture. Like we're going to do some meditation of speaking and listening. And once you find the posture that's conducive to really being here with this awareness only, this mind only, this thisness, it's conducive to being aware of how we feel, conducive to being aware of how we're connected. And then you can close your eyes if you'd like. And I'm going to ask people to speak very briefly. So if you're speaking, I request that you really try and keep it down to a sentence or two. So we don't want to go on long things, but really allow as many people as possible to make a very short statement. And first, I'd like to ask people to name something that you are more aware of because of your meditation practice that causes harm that you are letting go of, or you can see some letting go of through your practice. So the question is, like, what habits that you have are you more aware of and more able to let go of because of your practice? And I'll just ask people to be brave and just share. And please speak loudly, because we have people in two rooms, so you don't need to yell. But just stand up in yourself and be real.
Defensiveness.
Control.
Jealousy.
Fear.
Escape.
Fear and how it fuels anger.
Anxiety.
Can you say that one again?
Anxiety.
Thank you.
Insecurity. Negative interpretation.
Projecting my negativity.
How that affects others.
I heard shame and how I affect others.
Judgment.
Judging others based on my beliefs.
Taking things personally. Hiding my real feelings to control how others respond to me.
Power. Not being with this person. Maintaining fear and a sense of isolation.
Overwhelm. Regret.
Okay, I would like to shift the question. I'd like to thank you all for, and we'll do another round like this, but I'd like to just thank everyone for their offerings. It's offering connection, offering intimacy with how we feel. Co-creating a dream that's not bound by the past. So, using the same approach, you may need to use a few more words to respond to this. One word, a sentence, a couple sentences, it's all fine. But I'll request that people name something that you do that alleviates suffering outside of this building that is informed by your meditation practice. So this could be, have to do with your family or your work or volunteering or the way you conduct yourself in a specific context. Just anything. And, you know, there might be an impulse to either not want to sound like you're aggrandizing yourself, or an impulse to sound important and whatever. Just share. Just be real. Are you doing anything outside of this building that's informed by your meditation practice that is transforming suffering?
Really listening to others.
Reframing.
Being open to others.
Compassion. Consider for a moment why the reaction is happening and question before you do.
Thinking before I act.
Well, here, why don't you in the founders hall, why don't you speak first, please? Right, we couldn't hear you. Could you say it again?
She said she can't hear.
Oh. All right, well, I'll ask everyone to speak up. And then you over here on the lake side of the building, who just said something, could you say it again?
Asking questions.
Smiling.
Smiling? What was the other one?
Showing up fully. Verbally recognizing others.
Letting go of the results.
Being vulnerable.
Waiting longer for people to think to speak.
Raising up the issue of white privilege.
Trusting my co-workers. Pausing when in chaos. Going for a walk.
Having more patience.
Sitting outside, experiencing nature,
recognizing the suffering of others, working with students with cognitive disability and recognizing their joy,
mediating conflicts between people.
Trusting others to take care of themselves. Maintaining curiosity.
Speaking truth to power.
Not overthinking or taking things personally.
Okay, well, this is very good. This is inspiring. I like to be inspired. You guys can do it. So let's return to just a regular, comfortable seated position. Open the eyes. If they were closed. You guys are pretty good. Pretty good. I guess Suzuki said you're all perfect, exactly as you are, and you could all stand a little improvement. I don't really know. I don't think I can really judge that. But we're trying. I'll come back here and keep trying with you guys. Thank you. I will, if I guess we had some community speech, but if anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to say something.
about that when you're reading the story about the man, I can't remember the phrase, desires or wants medicine, give him medicine. Was it wants or needs or...
You come across an interesting thing. This text, they actually believe it uses all of them. I'm not like all that familiar with this text. I just found this like yesterday. I was like, wow. But he talks about needs, need food, need drink, those who need clothing, those who want garlands. I give garlands. I'll confess, I skipped the whole section that says, those who need jewels, I give jewels. Those who need pearls, I give pearls. I just thought that would be a little confusing. But why not be confused? This text is laden. There are hundreds of pages of jeweled flowers, of jeweled towers within lapis lazuli skies of diamond raining clouds upon. I mean, it's crazy. But what's interesting is it includes very much, it includes desire. It's like, that's part of the deal too. It's just part of the deal too. As a bodhisattva, my job is not to say, you don't really need that. No. I see as best I can what I can do and just give it away. Just give it away. Well, I think this is very good. So, I will thank you all and turn it over to Jim.